I was always uncomfortable in my own skin, is the truth, you know. I had that wonderful upbringing, but was always a very anxious kid. I was having panic attacks at the age of 10, 11, before I went to senior school, you know. Having bouts of depression, you know. I didn't know it at the time, you know. I always thought, I couldn't wait until I got older, like my cousins, and I thought, I won't feel like that then, you know. But I always felt like that. And then when I felt, I'd always drank, but, you know, my dad allowed a small amount of drinking, you know, in sort of controlled family circumstances. Yeah. But once I got to 16, 17, 18, and I was boozing, I just thought that was it. It just solved all my problems. I didn't feel anxious. I didn't feel depressed. I didn't feel intimidated. I wasn't paranoid. I wasn't jealous. I thought I was the life and soul of the party. And some nights I probably was, and a lot of nights I was just a pain in the arse. But it just became everything.
Welcome back to This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scolfor. We're now into season 6, focusing on mental fitness in the British construction industry, because historically, these working environments are not conducive to men being able to speak openly about mental health or mental well-being. And as the stats currently stand, construction workers are nearly 4 times more likely to die by suicide than the national average. Settle in for an amazing conversation that grabs you from the off and doesn't let go. At 49 years old, Mike the Roofer is now 14 years sober, whose primaries, as he says, were alcohol and cocaine. After having worked in the roofing industry since he was 18, Mike now owns his own commercial roofing company and is married with 2 children. After a series of ominous warnings in his early life, a misguided stint at rehab, and several years of 3-day benders, Mike finally devoted his life to a 12-step program. Mike's vulnerability, honesty, and conviction will no doubt prove to be an inspiration to anyone who has struggled with addiction, or to anyone close to someone struggling with addiction. Mike, thank you for coming on This Is Powerful.
Thanks for asking me.
So this is obviously our construction worker and people in the industry, basically tradesmen, owners of businesses, because I think it's a really important subject to talk about, mental well-being, addiction in that field.
Yeah.
Mike, we always go back to the beginning. Where are you from and how was your upbringing?
Upbringing was good. Born in Romford. Parents from the East End. Just a good upbringing. Do you know what I mean? Really nice parents. I mean, I'm going to give you the long version. The short answer is there was nothing there that would have suggested I was going to end up where I did end up. Do you know what I mean? When I was in my 30s. Really good parents. You know, Dad was and is very driven, very successful fella. You know, he started his own business in his early 20s, I think.
What business was that?
Commercial roofing, which is what I do now. I've done a copy and paste of him, basically. And did really well. He's one of the exceptionally smart men. Do you know what I mean? Like street smart, not book smart. You know, he's very proud of the fact that he's never read a book. You know what I mean? Only idiots read books, apparently.
I find them people fascinating that have done
he's brilliant, yeah.
financially incredibly well. I'm really shrewd at business.
Incredibly smart and very gregarious character, really great fun, brilliant problem solver, you know, everyone's mate, he's that type, the life and soul of the party. And can drive you nuts sometimes, don't get me wrong.
As a son, probably.
Exactly. But I mean, I love him to bits. And I mean, if I had to sum him up, I mean, about 5 years ago, he had a heart attack and me and my brother drove around to the house and he was sort of being taken by the paramedics into the back of the ambulance. And they strapped him all up and they said, like, you're having a cardiac incident. We're taking you to Barts. And my dad said, well, how long am I going to be there? Can I just sign the paperwork and go home? And they're going, like, you're having a heart attack, mate. No, you can't go home.
Yeah, it's actually you.
Yeah. And I mean, he had that heart attack. He obviously survived it. And I remember he went home on the Thursday and they told him just rest for 6 weeks, you know. Don't get off the sofa. And that was on the Thursday. He went back to work on the Monday. He was like, no, I can't stay at home, you know. And he's always been like that, you know. And good dad. I was very, very lucky. And a great mum. Do you know what I mean? Really, very warm, caring person, my mum, you know, sort of doted on me. I was very, very fortunate. Very, very fortunate. If you'd have asked me, sort of 20 years ago, I'd have said, yeah, I had really good parents, you know. Now, being a parent myself, and, you know, I spend a lot of time with guys that have had awful upbringings.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? I've heard some like horror stories. And I realised I didn't have really good parents. I had amazing parents. Do you know what I mean? I was very, very blessed. And we had all the material stuff. That was nice. You know, I went to good schools.
Where'd you go to school?
Originally, I went to a place called Parklands, which was in Rice Park. And then I went to Cooper's in Upminster.
Yeah, good school.
Good school. I went there in 88. It's a good school now. It was a very good school back then. And it was a bit of a culture shock for me, you know, because there was just a lot of bright kids there. Do you know what I mean? A lot of really sporty kids there. So it took me a while to settle in, but I did settle in and I loved it. And so there's nothing there really. You know, if you just looked at it, if it would, you know, the kids got everything going. I did have everything going, you know. And
did you know that you wanted to go into the same business as your dad?
I didn't know. Growing up, I really didn't know what I wanted to do, to be honest with you. I mean, I really enjoyed education. You know, I was never really sure. I was good at school, you know, and particularly as I got a bit older, you know, it was suggested that I go to university. You know, I didn't go to university. Drinking drugs put paid to that, but that was kind of going to be the plan. Mm. Didn't really know what I was going to do. Didn't ever think I was going to get into construction. Although I had worked construction, I worked for my dad's company since I was 13. It was different. It was like the 80s. So about sort of 88, 89, when I was like 13, I sort of went to work weekends and holidays. Mm. And I really enjoyed it. Do you know what I mean? And I made more money than all my friends.
Which is always a bonus.
Yeah. A lot of my friends have got the kind of the normal Saturday jobs, you know, like in McDonald's and, you know, those type of jobs, you know. And I was kind of out on roofs. And I was probably earning, well, it wasn't a lot of money, but it was probably double what everyone else was earning. Yeah. And I loved it. And I was spending, I mean, I know you was in construction for a period, weren't you? Mm. And
I started, funny enough, my neighbour when I was 15 asked me to help him. And and I was like, yeah, maybe it depends. And he said, oh, I'll pay you this. And I was like, okay, cool.
Yeah.
And I actually really enjoyed it. We did suspended ceilings
yeah.
in the 6 weeks holidays. And we did commercial buildings like schools, libraries and stuff when they was all shut.
Yeah.
The guy I worked with, when I think about it, he was a really lovely guy, but he terrified me at the same time. He had the worst rage I've ever seen. Yeah. I mean, my dad had it as well, but this guy was like, so I thought all men was like that.
Yeah.
But driving up there was like crazy getting there. And what he liked to do was work intensely until 2 o'clock because he wanted to be home by 3, which suited me as well. So it was actually taught me how to work really hard, be efficient and stuff like that. But it was a little crazy.
It's a little education, isn't it? I mean, I was like 13, 14, and I was working with guys that were 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. A certain type of guy, you know, like a working class guys. And it was I loved it. I just felt grown up. You know, I mean, I remember you'd never get away with it now, but I remember being 14 in with a lorry driver, driving a 7.5-ton lorry. I'd never driven a car. And I asked him questions, he said, well, have a go. And we was in Brighton. And I remember driving like a 7.5-ton lorry through the streets of Brighton at the age of 14. I really enjoyed it. And I worked really hard back then, you know. That wasn't the case as I was older. We'll come to that. But I worked really hard. And kind of all the guys told my dad that I worked hard and he loved that. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Because that's, you know, if you ask my dad, work harder, work harder, work harder. Yeah. You know, which is not bad.
No, but if you come from the East End, that is the best ethos to have to get you out.
Yeah.
It's usually not education driven, is it? So
my dad was very smart as well, but just had no interest in it, you know. And yeah, exactly. He was out scrapping from day one. So that was kind of good upbringing, basically.
When you started, so obviously he was working with your dad at 13 and stuff like that. So when you left school, did you finally think, well, it's an easy route to take to go into dad's business?
Well, what happened was I'd got really good grades at school. I was recommended to do A-levels, started doing A-levels. Was doing really well with the A-levels. Was recommended to try for university and didn't get into the university I wanted to get into. but had other offers. But round about that time, so what are you, 17, I basically discovered boozing and drugs and girls, and it just...
All in one night, all in the first night.
It was a long weekend. And round about that age, 17, 18, and it, all of a sudden, it was the only thing I was interested in, you know. And I went from working very hard and getting really good grades to not working very hard to like not bothering going to school. And
was that just like the guys you hung around with was going into the pub and you... Was it like the environment you liked, or you just liked the taste for beer and...
I was always uncomfortable in my own skin, is the truth, you know. I had that wonderful upbringing, but was always a very anxious kid. I was having panic attacks at the age of 10, 11, before I went to senior school, you know. Having bouts of depression, you know. I didn't know it at the time, you know. I always thought, I couldn't wait until I got older, like my cousins, and I thought, I won't feel like that then, you know. But I did feel, as I got older, I still felt like that. I managed it better, you know. But I always felt like that. And then when I felt, I'd always drank, but, you know, my dad allowed a small amount of drinking, you know, in sort of controlled family circumstances. Yeah. But once I got to 16, 17, 18, and I was boozing, I just thought that was it. It just solved all my problems. I didn't feel anxious. I didn't feel depressed. I didn't feel intimidated. I wasn't paranoid. I wasn't jealous. I thought I was the life and soul of the party. And some nights I probably was. And a lot of nights I was just a pain in the arse. But it just became everything. Do you know what I mean? I got sober at 34. And I used to share in meetings. Yeah, it got bad by the time I was 30. And it's true that by the time I was 30, it had annihilated me. I couldn't function. From that point, I mean, I couldn't function in any useful way at all. Mm. I couldn't go to work. I couldn't pay bills. I couldn't get out of the house, you know. I mean, it really destroyed me. But it started taking from me from day one.
Do you think that from your experience, because we, a lot of people that come on a podcast, whether they've had really lovely upbringings like yourself or horrendous ones, which some have had, seems to be a common thread that the person feels really anxious, has some depression, not sure what it is. But when they find something, whether it's a behaviour or chemical or alcohol, the reaction of the relief from that is like, I found the answer.
I could breathe again.
Yeah.
Or not even, I could breathe again. I could breathe. That's what it felt like, you know. And the thinking wasn't as linear as I've been anxious all my life. You know, it's probably an anxiety disorder. And now I'm self-medicating with alcohol and marijuana. I wasn't thinking like that. I just knew it was everything to me.
Yeah. You know,
looking back with hindsight. Stopped studying, you know, just right from the get-go, sort of swapped life for drinking drugs, basically. Messed up my A-levels because, I mean, one of them I didn't even turn up to. So I didn't have a good time. I didn't have much of a chance of passing it. I just didn't turn up. And
did your parents know about that at the time? Or?
I mean, they're not idiots. Do you know what I mean? Like, you know, they'd seen me kind of in my room studying, really grafting. And all of a sudden I was out five nights a week coming out, you know. So, and as I say, my dad's like, if you're in education, that's fair enough. But work, you know. And I didn't. You know, and he'd make comments and I told him he didn't know what he was talking about because he didn't know about education, which he didn't know about education, but he knew that you had to be there.
Yeah.
So they probably knew what was coming. You know, they probably knew it was coming before I did. And it was kind of a rude awakening. And I just kind of fell back into, oh, well, that didn't happen. I'm not going to university. I'm not going to study economics. And I was like, oh, okay. I wasn't even really thinking. I had offers for other universities. I'm thinking, yeah, I should probably deal with that at some point. But I didn't. I just got drunk. And then I kind of had offers of another job in the city. And I thought, yeah, I should probably deal with that at some point. And I didn't. I just got drunk. And I just kind of fell into working for my dad, which I'd done for, at that point for 5 years anyway, on and off. I just sort of fell into doing it full time. The difference was, at that point, I'm drinking and using.
Hmm.
And that 14, 15-year-old kid that all my dad's guys would say, yeah, he gets stuck in, you know, he grafts. They didn't say that when I was 18 because I wasn't getting stuck in, you know.
Hmm.
Didn't really want to be there. Felt I was better than it. I wasn't. you know. Felt I was better than them. I wasn't. And I was just waiting for, all of a sudden it was all going to magically change and I was going to get the incredible job that I deserved, you know.
Yeah.
Having done no work for. You know? And I just kind of got stuck into this routine of doing a job that I could have enjoyed, I'd always enjoyed, but didn't want to be there, so didn't enjoy. And would just get drunk every night, most nights, you know.
Do you think that it's funny, isn't it? Because it's like an unconscious thing.
Yeah.
If that becomes the answer, and I know what anxiety is like. A lot of people say they have anxiety today that I don't think they do have proper anxiety.
Sure.
Because it can be crippling, can't it?
Yeah.
And it's all encompassing, like planning to get out, planning to talk to people. How am I going to talk to that person? What am I going to wear? What's going on?
Yeah.
And then wondering as well why. I used to say to myself, I used to literally think, I think it's adrenaline problems. And I remember that at 13, like, I must have adrenaline problems.
Yeah.
Because A, I can't sit still, I can't focus, and I couldn't remember lyrics to any songs or names or anything. Right. And I understand now in hindsight, I was in fight or flight a lot of my childhood. But it's interesting when you find something so powerful to take that away, that clearly you're a sharp guy. And clearly you had the experience of working that decision-making was probably easy prior to drinking. And then it's mad that those things just get pushed aside as if you can't deal with them or they're not relevant, right?
Yeah. There's like when I got sober, I looked back and I thought my life had been blurred. So I started getting myself in trouble, say at 18, I got sober at 34. So what's that, 16 years? And it felt like life had just been blurry. I didn't think it at the time. At the time, I didn't think, I'm not really focusing here. I can't see clearly here. I'm not thinking rationally here. I was just kind of like falling from one disaster to the next. And I'm sure you understand, like, the disasters got worse every time.
Mm.
And they just kind of, they compound, don't they? And I solved that, or I try and solve that disaster by getting drunk. So now the disaster's even, and then I run and hide and, you know. And but when I come out of it, I just thought, I can't remember much of that. You know, I thought I did, but it was all kind of blurry and pieces were missing, and it just seemed bizarre. And then once I got a bit of like sober time under my belt, when I was, 1, 2, 3 years sober, I looked back and thought, like, what was I doing? You know, I was just making the most bizarre decisions and acting in the most like irrational way. You know, things that were against my best interest, things that were obviously antisocial. I was just kind of like sleepwalking through it all, you know. It felt like waking up.
It's funny, isn't it? How you come into sort of consciousness with sobriety. What? How did you, was there a point where like your dad or someone said, Mike, what are you up to? What are you doing? Because clearly.
Yeah.
This is, I mean, not...
it's the old trope, and it was fun. It was fun with consequences. It was just consequences. They were, you know. And by my mid-20s, you know, at that point, I was getting comments. You know, my dad was always on my case, quite rightly, by the way. You know, if I'd have worked for anyone else on the planet, I'd have been sacked 10 times over, you know, but I was essentially unsackable, you know. And my dad was always on my case. And then I had good spells, like I'd sober up for 6 weeks, you know, or rein in for 6 weeks, and it's about, all right, okay. Like the 15-year-old's back, we're good. And then obviously I'd go again. But by my mid-20s, it wasn't just him. You know, I had good friends that I'd grown up with who'd done all the stupid teenage stuff, you know, abroad, you know, and now they were 25 and they were sensible. They were acting like men and they would start to make comments like, that's unacceptable, mate. You know, you're a 25-year-old man. Pull yourself together. So my solution, rather than pulling myself together, I just got a new set of mates, you know. Just kind of just dropped my shoulder and started knocking about with kids that were 18 again. And when I got sober, as I say, I was like 34, I looked around, like a lot of my mates were kind of 18, 19, 20, which is no wrong way of having 18-year-old mates when you're 34, but...
No, but as a replacement for your own
I think that I picked them because they weren't calling me on my behaviours, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, my good friends were... so there was like a series of warning signs. I mean, I remember with an ex-girlfriend, kind of, I remember waking up and really, really needing a beer, And it was like I think it was like a Friday morning. I thought, it's okay, because it's Friday. So like at 6 o'clock on a Friday morning, I had a can of beer and her pulling me on it saying, well, that's not anywhere near normal. I was like, no, it's all right. I just feel a bit, you know, Just wanted to get ready for Friday. But it was morning drinking. You know, for a long time, I said, no, I never morning drank. I did.
When did that start?
I was about 26 then, I think, when that happened, you know.
Do you remember that feeling? Because I remember once I went back to the pub about 10 or 11 when it opened on a Sunday.
Yeah.
And had a beer, and I remember the feeling, you know, the hair of the dog. I was still drunk from the night before, and then having that beer and and going, okay, I'm all right now.
I belong. I'm safe.
Yeah, but it also, at the same time, scared me, because I was like, oh, that's not good.
I remember having going on a bender. This is a bit later on in the story, my early 30s here. At this point, I'm barely functioning at all. The drugs had come in, gone out, coming, and at this point they were running rampant, you know, and it would be very, very normal at that point to go like on 3-day runs, you know, phone off, no work, no communication, just drinking drugs. And I actually went on about a 3-day bender with an ex-girlfriend's sister, and we were just off from running, and we'd started on the Friday night, I can't remember, probably would have been the Friday night in North London. And then Sunday morning, we were looking for something. We hadn't stopped, and we were looking for somewhere to drink. And we were in a pub down the Holloway Road. It was a Wetherspoons, and it opened, I'm guessing, like 8 o'clock, you know. And we were sitting there drinking, and the whole pub was full with middle-aged men, scruffy middle-aged men, drinking Guinness at 8 o'clock on a Sunday morning. And I remember the ex-girlfriend's sister saying, "There's people in here drinking." I'm like, we're in here drinking. And it sort of clocked on her. And then I remember thinking, yeah, I don't think this is glamorous anymore, you know, because I'd kind of tried, some of it had been a bit glamorous, maybe, you know, I'd gone to kind of the nightclub, I'd done all that, you know, but that wasn't glamorous. And I mean, it got a lot less glamorous, you know, shortly after that. But there was, I kind of knew something wasn't right, you know, and I started probably around about the age of 30, I started tentatively confessing and asking for help, and would have all these kind of stupid ideas of how I was going to get it under control. All ridiculous, you know. They weren't ridiculous at the time, but looking back with hindsight, you know.
Was you living at home still then, or did you have your own place?
I had my own place. I had a place in Brentwood. I remember making a phone call to a very good mate. You know, I'd had like another one of those 4-day runs. At this point, I'm on my own. That girlfriend, you know, she's gone. I'm in desperate trouble again. I've done it again, you know. And at this point, like the coke's, it's 4 or 5 nights a week, and it's not a little, it's just me going from 7 p.m. to 5 a.m. You know, and I'm doing that a lot, and I just can't function really. And I called a good friend in, and yeah, my mum and dad knew obviously something was nuts, but I was living away from home, and my friends knew something wasn't right, and he kind of had an idea of the extent of it, maybe, probably more than most people, and I kind of spilled my guts out, and I said, look, you know, I've come up with an idea, and you're going to start drug testing me, and if I fail any drug tests, you got to tell the family, everyone, and you got to send me off to Rio, and then I'll accept it's over, you know. So these were the sort of things I was kind of, and I found a way to cheat the test. Do you know what I mean? And so I cheated the test, and then
did he actually test you?
Yeah, on a regular basis, but I found a way. I won't say it in case anyone else does it, but I found a way to cheat it. And then at some point later on in the story, you know, I have to go around his house and say, like, thanks for all your help, but I'm being shipped out to treatment. He was like, but you're clean. I'm like, no, I'm not. He's like, but you passed all the tests. I'm like, no, I haven't.
Bless him.
I mean, he's one of the loveliest people I know.
Cunning, right?
Yeah.
Shows our cunning. Once addiction takes hold, it's like, I remember when I was younger going to the London hospital to see my mum, and there was a guy in an alleyway on the floor asking for 10 pence. And my dad said, I said, give him some money, Dad, he needs something. And he's like, no, just spend it on booze, son. I went, no, he desperately needs the money, all innocent. And when we come out, he'd bought a bottle of, a litre of white spirits and done it, and was just, I've never seen anything like it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it just shows you the desperation of what you'll do and say, right? Hi, it's Paul here. I just wanted to take a moment to say thank you and to say if you've heard something on the show that's moved you, please follow, rate or review the show, and it'd be amazing if you could share it. Now back to the show.
I do remember with that little episode with my friend, you know, I got to 3 weeks and I was going insane, you know, because I knew he was testing me. I've changed my mind now. I don't want to not do it. I need to do it now. And I come up with the idea. And I mean, when I explained it to him, the look on his face was like, what on earth? You went to what lengths to pass the test? He was just sort of shocked, you know.
Yeah.
I shared that in meetings loads of times, and it kind of always gets a laugh, do you know what I mean? And but I had to find a way around it, you know.
Yeah.
And I got shipped out to treatment.
How was that?
It was an amazing place.
Did you ask to go, Mike, to treatment? Or
I think at this point I've been in and out of the meetings. I had at that point been in and out of the meetings with no real interest in doing what they were suggesting, but you know, I'm kind of just flailing about. And
do you think that was to prove to you was doing something about it, or was that for other people?
I think I wanted the consequences to go away. Do you know what I mean? I didn't want to stop drinking and using. I mean, what I wanted to do, I've shared this many times, but like, I wanted to drink at the weekends, 5-6 pints on a Friday, 5-6 pints on a Saturday, and do a bit of coke on special occasions, like my mates were doing, you know, at that age, you know. Not all my mates, some of my mates were still doing that. And that's what I wanted. And of course, I turned up to the meetings and that wasn't on offer, you know. And there's like, no drink, no drugs. And so I was out, I was in, I was out, I was in. And during that period, the timeline's a bit blurry, to be honest with you, you know, but it came out to the family that I'd been going to meetings, and someone in the meetings very kindly, you know, my dad's involved now, and dad is a problem solver, you know, has been all his life, but we have to solve this one, don't we? We have to do it ourselves. And I wasn't ready to, and the person from the meeting said, well, you know, if he wants to go to treatment, here's a really great place that I went to. That person had gone, he was out in Spain, and they'd gone wanting to get sober, and they got sober, you know. So I was flown out to Spain, and looking back, it was a brilliant place, fancy. It's not there anymore, it's closed down. One of the guys in particular, one of the counsellors, one of the most fantastic people I've ever met, you know. And often when I go back to Spain now, I'll arrange to meet him. I'll meet him and meet him, and we'll go for like a kebab afterwards or something. Oh, he's nice. Just a really, really cool. He's not a counsellor anymore. He's got in a different line of work, but he's just a fantastic fella, you know. And I knew I liked him. But I wasn't ready to give up. I had to find a way, you know. I remember saying to that guy at some point, like, no, I think I can work it out. And I remember him saying to me, like, look where you are. You're in a treatment centre up a mountain in Spain. We've locked all the windows and the doors so you can't get out. Like, you're not like your friends. And I knew he was right, but I didn't want him to be right. You know, I just wasn't ready. And I behaved myself really well out there. You know, I did all the jobs. My job was cleaning the swimming pool, you know. Because I was so well behaved, I was allowed to watch a match of the day on Saturday night because there was no television. Me and one other guy were like little teacher's pets, I suppose, and they let us watch match of the day, and I used to love it because it was kind of a bit of normality. But I knew I was going to drink.
How was that fit? How would that feel? Because that's... Were you being like the teacher's pet, what you said, to honour the process, or to be like, I am a nice guy, to leave that stain of I am a nice guy before you go out and do what you're going to do?
I think when I'm sober, I just behave myself. Do you know what I mean? I'm a decent, I'm not a saint, but I'm a decent guy when I'm physically sober. And I could just tell they were nice people, and they said, these are the rules. I was like, okay, they're the rules, I'll obey the rules, you know. Would you like to do a job? Yeah, I'll do a job, no problem at all. You need to be in group at this point. I got there early. But, because that's what they asked me to do. I knew my dad had paid a lot of money for it. I had no money. I'd spent all my money on cocaine. I had a mountain of debt. So I did the right thing, you know. But I didn't believe. I remember going for a walk on a Saturday night. I was allowed out to go for a walk because I was so well behaved. And I thought, right, I've got to get my head around this. Like, am I going to be sober? And I kind of walked up this mountain, and it was like dusk on a Saturday night. It was beautiful. And I remember sort of thinking, right, Can I do it? Do I want to do it? Get sober. And I came to the conclusion, I probably could, but I don't want to. Like, you know, and I walked back down the mountain again. And that, and I kind of, and I drank on the plane on the way home, you know, which I've told that as a funny story in meetings, but I'm a dad now. My dad picked me up from the airport.
How was that?
It broke his heart. Now, looking back, I could see it broke his heart because, you know, I'm his boy. He's a problem solver. He sent me off to this fabulous place. I'll see you in 6 weeks. And I land at 6 weeks at Stansted Airport on EasyJet, and I've had a beer on the plane. Do you know what I mean? So he told... I mean, when I was about a year sober, as my dad's a tough guy, I mean, he kind of just forward. Doesn't show a lot of emotion. Shows almost no emotion, apart from the grandkids. That's very different, but, like, you know... And when I was about a year sober, and he obviously realised, oh, he's serious now, and things were good, we had a phone call, and I remember him saying, I just always assumed I was going to find you dead, boy. Which, I've got an 8-year-old son and a 12-year-old daughter. What must that be like for the parents?
Yeah.
What must it be like to think he's going to die? And it did get to that stage in the end. I know different people get off the ride at different stages, but I was having overdoses, you know. I had a season ticket at the local hospital, and sometimes I'd turn up and it'd be an overdose and they'd have to sort me out, and sometimes it was just a really bad panic attack, and, you know, I thought I was overdosing, and, you know, he saw that. Not all of it, but he saw some of that, and it must have, you know...
That must be heartbreaking for him.
I can't imagine what it would be like. You know, I can't imagine. My daughter has a bad day at school. My son doesn't have a football game and he's upset. It upsets me. Do you know what I mean? So, yeah. Like, to think they've got, like, a raging drug problem... And it looks like they're going to die. I mean, it must.
How did he react to that initially? Because my dad's, I don't know, how old's your dad?
He will be 79 this year.
Okay, yeah. So my dad's about 10 years older. He never knew anything really about me because I travelled with my job all the time. And I lived in, most of the time when it was a problem, was Miami, New York and LA. And when I come back to London for my last year, he's someone that's like, he's really old school, tough East End guy. Doesn't show emotions at all. Thankfully, I'm getting a glimpse of my grandkids, his grandkids as well. But I never really drank in front of my dad. And he never really see anything at all. Because I was mostly away. And when I'd go around there, I'll either be depressed or have a hangover or be just survive the day and go and have some lunch with him. But when... I got my sister at the time to phone my parents to say I was going into treatment. And I said to my sister to say to Dad, like, don't worry, it's okay, because he had no idea, but he just doesn't know anything about drugs or whatever. And he was like, he said to her, like, he shouldn't go, he's definitely not got a problem, there's nothing wrong with him, because he hadn't seen any of it.
Yeah.
And then when he came up to the treatment centre, I think it was about 3 or 4 weeks in, my mum come up, she put marigolds on because it was a drug addict place and she didn't want to touch the door. I was like, Mum, you're making me feel really bad. She goes, well, I don't know what kind of place this is, do I? It was a really nice treatment center. But anyway, and my dad, they did a thing where the parents come in. My dad went up and I remember Hilary Betts, who was one of the lead treatment center ladies, went therapist. Said, like, to my dad, oh, look, your son's got a big drug problem. And as soon as she said that, he stood up in front of him and was like, my son doesn't have any problems. Don't talk to him about it. And left.
Yeah. That was it. About dealing with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is how far gone I was. I remember he dropped me off. I didn't want him to take me. I think it was Stansted. I said, please just let me go. All the shame and everything, you know, I'm probably... 4 days clean or something, you know. And I remember saying, please let me take you, boy. And I kind of give in. I had the ump because I wanted to go on my own. And he dropped me off at Stansted. And I'm sort of started walking. And I turned around and his car had turned around. He'd come back the other way and I saw it. And he was crying. I've never seen my dad cry. When his dad was very ill, he nearly cried and he held it back. That's the closest I'd seen. And he was crying in the car. And I was so... gone at the time on the drink and drugs. I remember thinking, why is he crying? And it never dawned on me for one second that he was upset that he dropped off his eldest son at an airport because he's going to fly out to a drug and alcohol treatment centre. Never dawned on me. I just thought, what strange. I've never seen him cry. I wonder what that's about. Oh, well, here we go. And off I went, you know. So
when did that dawn on you? Because it's quite a thing.
I remember getting a flashback of that when I was, I don't know, 2 years sober. I was probably having one of these conversations. And then I remembered it. I thought, Jesus, like that. It just never sank in,
yeah.
You know. There came a point around about that period when, you know, I was going to treatment. People said, look, just tell him everything. And I sort of blurted it out about the drug. He just thought I was mad. He thought I was mad and I drank too much and there was something weird going on. And, you know, He'd send me to all these incredible psychiatrists. He'd pay a fortune, you know. I'd go and see, like, you know, fantastic people. And I just lied to him. You know, and then I'd sort of pull myself together and I'd say, oh, the psychiatrist said, and we'd had a great problem solved, you know, and I'd be good for 2 weeks and go off again, you know. Yeah. And then he found out about the drugs, my mum found out about the drugs, and then he went for a stage of being angry, and I don't blame him at all. My mum went for a stage of blaming herself, you know, I've told her 1,000 times, honestly, you know, but still to this day, sometimes she'll make comments, you know.
I think that's a mother's trait.
I think so. I mean, what I try and say to an heir is, well, if you're going to take responsibility for the drug addiction, then you've got to take responsibility for the fact that I'm long-term sober.
Mm.
I'm married to an incredible woman. I've got 2 beautiful children. I've started my own business. I've run marathons. You've got to take credit for that as well. You can't pick a side, mum, you know. And
that's a good way of saying it.
Yeah, and it's the truth as well. You know, she's either responsible or she isn't, you know. Yeah. You know, and my mum, she's a softer, warmer character. So, you know, she rang me up crying, saying, you know, I can't remember, but it was, you know, it was just, we love you. Just do what you got to do. You know, we're here for you. And, yeah, 2 very different reactions.
What was the point? So after treatment, you come back and you carried on. What was the moment for you? Were you like, do you know what, I'm stopping, and did you go straight into meetings for that?
So I think it was roughly about 4 years from my first meeting to my last drink, I think. Again, it was all very blurry. Probably halfway through that journey is when I went to treatment, I'm guessing, probably 2 years before I got sober. And in that period, I'd met the woman you've met my wife, you know, and she was just going through a divorce. And we started dating, and I'd disappear for a week, and then I sort of dust myself down, all right, I'm out, and, you know, and I was somehow able to kind of manage. I knew she was special.
Mm.
I'd never met anyone like her. And I was somehow able to kind of put on this, I did a very good impression of normal when I'd go out of her, do you know what I mean? And after dating for, I'm going to say, like, I don't know, 4 or 5 months, very quickly, she was selling, like, the marital home. I was like, oh, moving with me. And I thought, this will do me. I've got a really good woman, you know. That's it. I'll be able to drink normally. And, of course, that's not what happened. Mm. And she moved in and she found out she was living with a raving lunatic. Do you know what I mean? And it was all where she comes from a, there's none of that in her family. Do you know what I mean? So she just found it. Like my dad for a while, she just thought, well, he's nuts. Do you know what I mean? Like, because I would literally, like, see him 20 minutes and I'd be back 3 days later, like, with these bizarre stories, you know. And she was very patient and tolerant and loving at first. And like everyone else, eventually that patience ran out. You know what I mean? How I held on to her, I will never know. Do you know what I mean? And, but she hung in there, bless her. Thank God she did. And, so in that period, I had a lot of normal life in front of me because I wasn't just living on my own. I was living with someone that got up every morning, went to work, played sport in the evening, spend the weekends with her family, you know, did just everything was kind of normal. And I was this little odd fella that would kind of just go missing for days on end and, you know, and I was just kind of confronted. I just kept on bumping into reality. There was a family holiday in... her family holiday in Portugal. I mean, I got sober in August 2011, so I think it was like the July. And I sort of dusted myself down. And I remember thinking, don't drink on this holiday. and I got picked up at the airport by the father-in-law. And he said, "That's a shame you're not going to have a drink." And I thought, "Yeah, I'll have a drink. Yeah, if you want me to." That was all I needed. Mm. I ruined that holiday for everyone. And my missus still can't talk about that holiday. Like, to this day. We've been out with friends. I mean, I've told the funny anecdotes or the sad anecdotes. And they've sort of said to Jenny, like, "Oh, is that true what happened in Portugal?" She said, "I don't want to talk about it." You know, that's kind of
you
the...
You might have done a good job of
that. That's the extent I did. I mean, not only was no one talking to me at the end of that holiday, they weren't talking to each other. Like, the mother-in-law wasn't talking to the son-in-law wasn't talking... I just caused chaos. And they're just a really normal, quiet family. It's just like an alcoholic, drug addict bomb went off in this, you know, in this villa in Portugal. And I come back from there, and the relationship was on a thread, and I had no money, but I was up to my eyeballs in debt, and I was utterly desperate, you know, and I'd been like that for a long time, and I kind of knew I had to make a decision, really. And I remember going out the last drink. I remember saying to the missus, "I'm just nipping out 5 minutes," and I remember saying, "Please don't drink," and I wasn't going to drink. I don't know what I was doing. She's like, "Yeah, I know, but please don't drink." I was like, "I'm not going to drink." And I come back 3 days later. And when I come round of it, I remember waking up. It was a really lovely sunny day. And I just knew it was over. I don't know why on that day in particular. But I knew I had to make a choice of, all right, just drink yourself to death. You know, get on with that. And say goodbye to everything. Or go back to the meetings and take it seriously. And I thought I'll go back to the meetings and take it serious. I remember thinking to myself, and again, this is another sign of, it's very sad where my head was. I remember thinking, I'll do all the things they've been telling me to do for the last 4 years. I'll really have a go at it. I'll do it for 6 months. And if it doesn't work, I'll drink myself to death. And that was like that, the insane thing is, that was like a viable option at the time. Oh, well, yeah. I'll just drink myself to death. There's always that option, you know.
Yeah. But it's really sad, isn't it?
Desperately sad. Do you know what I mean? Like, I had an incredible woman, incredible parents, all the opportunities in the world, great mates. A lot of them had the, you know, a lot of them relationships were strained, to say the least. Mm. But it was all there. It was all there for a really good life. Very, very privileged, you know, what I'd been given in life. And I was thinking, well, I'll try AA for 6 months, and if not, I'll drink myself to death.
So it clearly worked.
It did work, thank God. I started off in CA. I woke up, you know, on the Sunday, and on the Thursday I started step work with a guy who I'm still friends with today. And I asked him to help me because I believed him when he said he was happy. I don't know what your experience was, but you come to the meetings when I wasn't really sure, and you'd hear people talking about how happy they were, and I thought, well, how can you be? You're not drinking,
yeah.
You know? But I really believed him. His name was Alex. His name is Alex. A really, really cool bloke. Very, very different to me, you know, in many ways, in his lifestyle and stuff. But I asked him if he'd take me through the steps, because that was the thing I was terrified of doing. I don't know why, but I was just terrified of it. And off we went. You know, it shocked me how it worked, because I thought I was going to be one of those it was never going to work for.
Mm.
And I sort of went in. Looking back, I mean, I missed out so much of it. So much it went over my head. Do you know what I mean? Because it's, you know, I was probably like less than a month sober when I did my step four. I mean, I was taken through it at quite a pace. Yeah. And a lot of it kind of went flying by, but enough of it stuck in, and it worked. And I couldn't believe it. You know.
When was the moment that you turned around and thought, bloody hell, I'm actually sober. Like, I'm actually sober and doing this and it's okay.
I was 6 months sober. I was in my home group. So at that point, I've done my four and five. I'm doing my nines. So 6 months sober, I'm training for a marathon. I was 3 days sober and I signed up for the London Marathon. Why not? The guy that got me in the place of the marathon... he's a guy called Dr. Adrian Whiteson, and he started the Teenage Cancer Trust, or is certainly very heavily involved in the Teenage Cancer Trust. And he's kind of a big name. He was like the doctor for the British Boxing Board of Control, and he was Tottenham Hotspur's doctor. And I rang him up. I said, like, Adrian, get me a place in the London Marathon. I'm 3 days sober. And I remember him saying, well, I can, Michael. I can. but are you going to run it? And I thought, of course I'm going to run it, you know. And so that's where I was at that point. Life's taking off. I mean, and the kind of missus is talking to me again. I'm at work every day and my dad's happy and everything's fantastic. And I remember sitting in my home group and I just thought, do I want to drink? Because that was the thing. And I felt safe to think about it because I was surrounded by all my new mates. Mm. And I kind of envisaged what it would be like to have a drink. And I thought, I don't fancy that at all. And it shocked me. Like, you know, I just got almost like, it physically shocked me that I didn't want to drink. You know, I enjoyed being sober. That's the bit that, it still surprises me a bit today, to be honest with you. Do you know what I mean? I always thought, I love a drink. I love drinking. And I actually now think I just hated being sober before recovery.
Yeah.
I just think I was so uncomfortable, sober, physically sober. It wasn't I loved drinking, it just, I wasn't sober. That's what I now think that's what it was.
How has that changed for you in the sense of, I have suffered terribly from anxiety and that, but walking this path, and I think what's a really important point is as well, before I got sober, I thought people who got sober was like people who say, I'm not smoking for the day. They're looking at the cigarettes and thinking, oh, I'm not going to have one. I'm not, give me a chewing gum or give me a sweet. I'm not going to have one. But the most incredible thing, in my experience, I did the 12-step program too and other practices, but having that moment when you realise that you don't need to have a drink or a drug or you don't want to, completely blew my mind. I never realised how much dependent I was on stuff to medicate, to get rid of the anxiety or fears or try and be someone different than when I really realised I don't want that.
I mean, and I never realised just how much, what's the best way to describe it? I'm very, very comfortable in my own skin today, most of the time. Do you know what I mean? And I've got a really good idea of kind of who I am and what I like and what I do and what works and what doesn't. And when I look back, I'm sometimes surprised at just how little I knew about myself. I mean, what I thought made me happy and what I thought I had to do and what other people thought of me. And it was very, very distorted, you know. And that's really what recovery's been for me. It's a kind of a progression of just going through life, coming across stuff that I find difficult, blaming someone or something else for it, trying to change them. That's what I normally do for a bit. Realising it's not them. You know, it's how I'm responding to it that's the problem. And sort of changing myself. And the more I've done that, the more enjoyable life's become.
That's a powerful statement to make, though. Because a lot of people don't know themselves. I was told early on, I'm not my thinking. And I thought, thank God for that, because if you thought it was going in my head, it's not a good place to be.
Yeah.
And I understand that now, and I can watch my thought process and laugh at it or think, okay, that's not very smart. Or actually, it's all right. Yeah. Depends.
I've got a therapist as well who's fantastic. I'm very, very lucky. I'm just blessed. I've got an incredible sponsor. You know my sponsor. And he's just a really cool bloke. Like he's my dad's age. He's 79. Not saying my dad's not cool, but they're very two very different personalities, you know. And I'll sort of go to him with something and he'll never sort of tell me what to do. Never tell me off, you know. You just sort of listen to him and just kind of ask a few questions, you know. And 5 minutes, 5 days, 5 weeks, 5 months later, I say, do you know what I think I'm doing? And he'll just laugh and go, yeah, we all know you're doing it. Yeah. He's brilliant. Do you know what I mean? We all know, mate, yeah. And I've got a fantastic therapist as well. And I started to see her because I realised there was some other stuff that I wasn't going to address with 12-step in the, you know, that's the bedrock of it all for me. Get clean and sober, get your thinking straight, get your behaviour straight most of the time. And then I realised there was some other stuff that's not going away, you know, and it's not alcoholism, it's not addiction, it's something else. And just had some incredible moments with her, you know, which is the freedom that comes from it.
Well, that's because you're telling the truth now as well.
100%. Yeah. You know what I mean? And those two people, you know, my sponsor and my therapist, I've not just everything I've ever done, everything I've ever thought. And why I fought it and where it came from. And And the more you pick apart, you know, I love it. You know, and sometimes it's quite tough therapy. You know, and mate, who kind of introduced me to the therapist, said, like, he said, some days it's like swimming through treacle in sessions.
Mm.
And I have had sessions with that. You know, right, I thought, oh, no, I've got to hold this for a week now until I see her again. But when you come out the other side of it and you realise all the stuff you're carrying.
Yeah, you've earned your badges again, haven't
you? I just feel like light as a bird. It's, you know, it's lovely. So
How's dealing with being in the construction industry, and you have your own company, so you're the boss.
Yeah.
How do you find it now compared to before? Because there's always money involved, there's questions, there's timelines, there's a lot of detail, right?
Yeah.
How do you find pressures of speaking to people for someone who used to have anxiety to compared to now?
Well, I mean, I can only really... a lot of time when I was working with my dad, I mean, I was actually on site, and then he kind of brought me in the office, and I never really dealt with anything, is the truth. One of the biggest differences is... it doesn't bother me having awkward conversations now. Even in early recovery, I would do things and I'd get involved in contracts and I would pay for things and I'd tolerate things that I knew was no good for me or my company because I didn't want to have that 45-minute awkward conversation and upset someone, you know. And losing a load of money is a really great way to change that habit quick. You know what I mean? It's like a real good, you know, when you actually look, oh, Christ, that's cost me a fortune. So I just had to sort of buckle up and just sit down and have conversations with people, and it just all runs a lot smoother. You know, I'm very, very lucky to people I work with. I've got the kind of management staff I've got, I'm very, very lucky. You know, they're really good. They're really honest with me. I'm as honest as I can be with them, you know, and we just deal with things together. I don't lie to anyone, in the team. I just say, this is where we are. This is what's good. This is what's bad. And as I say, like just dealing with clients, I don't really have any anxiety about, you know, spending time with them. I just don't find it difficult. I enjoy it, you know. And
but don't you ever think that's amazing?
Yeah,
because that's really amazing. There's such a change, isn't it, from a child that had so much anxiety that used substances to change that to now being free of all of it.
Yeah, it is amazing, and it's I just feel very lucky. Statistically, not many of us get it, do we? It's just a fact.
No.
You know. And I don't know if I was just really, really lucky or, you know, or just at somehow, some point 14 years ago, I found enough grit to get started. I don't really know. I can't really explain it. You know, it still seems a bit bizarre sometimes. You know, cause when I was in the drinking and the drugging, I remember thinking, surely it's not going to end up like this. You know, surely this has to change at some point. But I couldn't. I just kept on sort of tripping over myself, you know. And God willing, in August, I'll be 15 years sober. And I think about that, I think, Jesus, how did that happen? Do you know what I mean? And I've got a really, really, like, good man. I'm blessed with a wife and kids. It's a really nice home. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And I sometimes come home to it, or not. My wife's in a good mood and we have a laugh and a joke and the kids are really pleased to see me and we just have a really nice, nice, normal existence. And I sort of get in bed at, like, I don't know, over 10:30 and think, like, how did it happen? You know, it's crazy.
It's lovely, isn't it?
It's beyond lovely, yeah. I mean, I come home last night and my son's made a key ring with Dad on it, you know. It was just on the bed. And this morning, my daughter knew it, and they both knew I was doing this. And she left me a little post-it note, good luck on the podcast, Daddy. And things like that.
Yeah.
I've shared this many, many times. When I first got sober, I thought, right, what do I want out of recovery? And what I wanted, the two big things I wanted a really flash sports car, and I wanted to get invited to sober parties with sober celebrities. That was really important to me. Neither of those things have happened. I now know the reason why is so I thought everyone would say, oh, he was at that party with so-and-so and he turned up and he's he must be incredible if he's doing that. You know, I wanted other people to validate me.
Yeah.
And I wasn't even aware of those little things of, you know, your daughter leaving a post-it note or your, you know, the other day when I was talking to my son, I said, who's your best mate? He went, you're my best mate. it's like worth $1 trillion. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Having a cuddle with him. It's just the joy you get from that.
Yeah.
You know?
One last question.
Yep.
If someone's in your industry particularly, or yep. generally in the construction industry, they're struggling, they're drinking too much, or they know they're addicted to stuff, what would you say the best thing for them is to do?
I mean, I'm just a massive fan of the meetings. Do you know what I mean? AA, NA, CA. I do all three of them.
Yeah.
Get yourself to a meeting, you know, and just get to as many as you can. We know there's cases where sometimes the meeting aren't enough. I've got some really good friends. The meetings weren't enough at first, and they had to go and get some specialist help. So, you know, if you can get into a treatment centre, if you're at that point, you know, if you feel that... But for me, I just don't think you can do enough meetings, you know. And there is a solution on offer. That's the point. Don't have to like it, don't have to try it, but, you know, we are there, you know, if you want to change.
Mike, thank you very much.
Thank you, Paul.
This is Powerful is brought to you by Stride Foundation UK, which educates the public about addiction, recovery, and the wealth of surrounding issues. We use lived experience and evidence-based science to support those in recovery and those struggling with addiction. To find out more about what we do, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com. You can also donate. Please donate. It really, really helps us to put this on for you guys. It will help us to break the stigma of addiction. It will also help us to educate more of the population, and it will allow us to bring you more episodes. Thank you. See you next time.